morning. Good to see you all this morning. I am excited to continue in our second installment of our Exodus series. It has so many jewels for us just to mine for our lives, both individually and as people. And why is that? I thought, why is this such a vital book? Why am I so full of faith for this book and our study of it right now? And honestly, I think it's just that life, life. Life is a process, isn't it? I mean, if you walk up to somebody on the street at Birch and Brea and you said, it doesn't matter what they believe, whether they're Christian or not, whatever they believe, you say, life is a process, they would be like, so true, so true. I don't even know what you mean by that, but it is so true. We just know that life is a process. And really, anybody that's lived for any amount of time in the world would agree that what we achieve in life, what we accomplish, what we're able to do, whatever the net outcome of our life is really the product of a process. And process is good. Process is necessary. It's a sequence of events that lead to whatever we hope to be or do or accomplish, and it's really just a fact of life. The problem is, this process is often painful. And even if we're quick to acknowledge that it's just part of life, the moment it gets tough is the moment our common sense that life is a process just disappears. We're like, I didn't expect this in the process. And when someone says, and honestly, this one makes me nuts. It's true, but it just makes me nuts. You know, it's not about the end, it's about the journey. Like, no, it's not. It's about the end. I just want to get to the thing. And yet, it's a process. And in truth, most of us have very little patience, very little endurance, and definitely not enthusiasm for the process, even if we earnestly believe that what we're experiencing is actually leading us somewhere. And the beauty of this passage we're studying today is really that, and just the entire book of Exodus, it's that it helps us understand the process. Don't you want to better understand the process? Don't you want to have patience for the process? Don't you want to become a master of the process? Part of the reason that we love and worship Jesus, that we regard him so highly, is he was a master of the process. You ever think about that? He went through a process, but he was an absolute master of it. He showed us what it means to actually go through the process, to endure the process, to enjoy the process, to master the process. And he gives us the power to be masters of the process. Isn't that amazing to think about? That is why we cannot shift or move from the person of Jesus, even as we look in these old ancient books about this people of God, Israel. We want to know and understand what he knows and understands. And this book is going to help us do that. The story, as we open up in Exodus 1, Alan brought us kind of right up to this point and talked about Joseph, as he mentioned. And basically Joseph says, hey, I'm going to die, but God is still going to be faithful to take you out of this land. He's going to bring you out and bring my bones with me. So that's where Alan left us. Now, I would love for Exodus 1:1 to say, and then God brought them out to the land flowing with milk and honey. Is that what it says? Somebody just checked. Does it say that? It doesn't say that. In fact, this moment does not come for a long, long time. We'll get there. But why doesn't it say that? Like, why doesn't it just say that? Why does it have to be a process? Why does it have to be such a long and convoluted and complex process that we're going to learn about? But why doesn't it just, bam, done, end of the book? Nothing else happens after that. I mean, isn't that what we would love for our own lives? We have some vision, some idea, some promise for something, and we just get to leap to it. Why does it have to be a process? What's the point of that process? I think we've got some clues in this book. And in fact, where we land after that wonderful news that, by the way, it's all going to be good someday, is in the midst of a very, very difficult situation. I start in Exodus 1, verse 7. Because basically, Joseph had died, and the rest of his family are gone, but their children and their grandchildren have multiplied significantly. And it says in verse 7, but their descendants, the Israelites, had many children and grandchildren. In fact, they multiplied so greatly that they became extremely powerful and filled the land. Eventually, a new king came to power in Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph or what he had done. He said to his people, look, the people of Israel now outnumber us and are stronger than we are. We must make a plan to keep them from growing even more. If we don't, and if war breaks out, they will join our enemies and fight against us. Then they will escape from the country. So the Egyptians made the Israelites their slaves. They appointed brutal slave drivers over them, hoping to wear them down with crushing labor. And as we jump to verse 14, it said they made their lives bitter, forcing them to mix mortar and make bricks and do all the work in the fields. They were ruthless in all of their demands. This hardly seems like what Joseph was talking about. They find themselves in the midst of a struggle. And so two things are going on here. The amazing thing is they seem to be growing wildly. I mean, they're growing all over the place. God is bringing fruitfulness. I mean, how do we know that it's God? I'll get to that in just a moment. But then the other thing that's going on here is that they're under extreme oppression, abuse, and even torture that is actually intended to kill them. The only way they're going to stop growing is if the new ones start dying, as if they actually hold the population where it's at, and yet God is bringing huge growth. And I'm thinking to myself when I read this, I'm like, well, how bad was it? I mean, why was he so afraid, Pharaoh? Like, was it really notable? And what's amazing to this is that actually the Israelites were in Egypt for 430 years. So I just want to give you like a two-second history moment here. Okay, that's interesting. For the first 215 years, when Jacob, named Israel, who was Joseph's father, came into Egypt, for the first 215 years, they grew to 70. Which makes sense. Like, I started to do the math for my own, like, okay, my parents got married in 1971, this is 47 years later, my family's 12. Like, that seems like normal growth, even like a little bit slow growth, if you consider there's some exponential. In the 250 years after that, by the time the Israelites left Egypt, they were 2.4 million. So it was supernatural growth. I mean, I can't imagine any family turning into 2.4 million. It said they had 600,000 fighting men. Now you start to get a picture. Oh, okay. No wonder the guy was getting nervous. They were popping them out like rabbits. I mean, it was bizarre. And it was frightening. It was unnatural. It was supernatural. And so, you know, I start to look at it and I'm thinking, man, what must they have been thinking? I mean, even the Israelites must have been rather surprised by this, but actually, numbers, it was a numbers game in those days, right? You actually had power by your numbers. So you would think they're starting to get pretty confident, and yet they were under this brutal slavery. So you've got both of these things going on right now. And honestly, it's somehow the unfolding process and plan of God. And I think we've got to pause for a moment because it's easy to start to look at these stories kind of for our own personal life, and that's exactly right. But actually, this story applies not just to Christians around the world, not just to Southland's Church here in Brea, California. It does apply to us, but we've got to take this story and try to understand what is God trying to say to us. That thing that you're in as you sit here right now on a Sunday morning at 10 a.m. is a process. That thing you return to when you leave here today and go to lunch or go home or go to work is a process. We all know that, but how can we be helped in understanding exactly what that is going to look like and how to manage and navigate it. So that is my first point. All of this is leading up to the big, oh, duh, God's will is a process. And why do I say that? Because I think if we think of like God's will, the plan of God in our lives, we think of moments, right? We think of achievements. We think someday, I think God's plan is for me to be a blank or a blah, 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 or it's for me to do this thing or that thing or to go to this place. That feels like the plan of God, right? It's events, it's moments, it's accomplishments, it's achievements, it's visions of things. But actually, if we consider that God's will is more of a process than it is individual achievements, events, or moments, it helps. Because all we want to do is understand God's will, right? What is God's will for my life? Well, if we think of it in the absence of a process, we're going to be very disappointed. And we learn about the character of God and the way he unfolds this process as we look at how he does that in the midst of the Israelites and of Moses, who we also encounter in this passage. So that's my first point. God's will is a process. It's what we know, but we've got to pay special attention to that point if we're really going to grasp what God has for us. My second point is the process is painstaking. I don't have to convince you of that. It can be beautiful. But the unfolding plan of God can also be painful. And not only does it seem to be painful, it seems that that's a vital part of the process. Again, he could have just plucked them out of this terrible situation, not by all of what's going to happen in the following chapters, and yet he saw fit for this to be a process. Why are we not spared of more of that pain? Those answers don't come easily, but as we study, we begin to understand what it is that God is doing and what the outcome of it is that we could never have quite counted on. We never would have known, it comes to pass by this process. And not only in the pain of the process were the Israelites slaves. I mean, that was horrible. If any of what is going on here was going on anywhere in the world, we would be outraged, right? If there was, you know, slavery of a people and they were being worked to death, if anybody knew about it, I mean, Amnesty International would be there. We would be disgusted by it. We would do everything we could to stop it or to alleviate it. And here it is happening. And not only is it happening, Pharaoh then says in verse 15, it says, "Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live." So not only were they subject to this terrible slavery, the guy was killing their kids. I mean, this process, that's starting to become a dirty word when you think about it this way. It's just unimaginable. It's just unbearable. And you've got to be sitting there going, why would it be by this process that God is doing what he intends to do? It doesn't really make any mention of him at the moment. As all of these things are going on, the last mention of God throughout these verses we've studied is back at the end of Genesis. There's nothing about what he's doing in the midst of this. And it just seems as though sometimes, as it looks like in this story, the trial, the pain, the suffering that we experience is by an ungodly instrument. I mean, what kind of process is that? What kind of justice or goodness is there in that? And sometimes when we seem to be experiencing this in our own lives, right, we go, oh, well, this is clearly the work of an enemy. I just feel like huge resistance, and I feel like I'm being treated unfairly, and everywhere I look, I'm running into a brick wall, or I'm suffering in ways that I never expected to. This must not be the will of God. I mean, isn't that true? We often feel like, well, this must not be the will of God if we are suffering in that way. And this passage doesn't quite let us make it that simple. It may be, It may be that God actually wants us to turn to him in the midst of our suffering, and he wants to release us. And yet, it may also be that there is a process at play. That sometimes it's by an ungodly instrument that we are actually suffering, that we are struggling. And it's very difficult to grasp how it is that he would want us to be experiencing this. But it helps us even further, because not only do we have the Israelites in the midst of this, now in just as we get into chapter 2, and that's just sort of a snapshot of what's happening in chapter 1. The Israelites are enslaved. Pharaoh is wanting to kill their kids. He is persecuting them terribly. And yet we get another clue, even in the sort of early manifestation of the calling of God in this process. It's something that we begin to realize, that not only did this happen with the people, it happens with an individual. It happens with Moses. And sort of to kind of fast forward into chapter 2, what happens is Moses is born. Now, Moses is born during a time when all of these kids are being killed. All of these male children are being killed. And as some of you may know, the very famous story, actually his mother hides him for 3 months and keeps him because she knows that he's in great danger. And after she keeps him, she actually takes him and puts him in a basket and puts him in the Nile River as a means to protect him, hoping that he will be found by somebody who doesn't kill him. Because at that point, all of the Egyptians now are ordered to kill any of the male babies of the Israelites. And so she does. She puts him, and immediately after, I mean, can you imagine a 3-month-old baby? It was by the river that Pharaoh was ordering them to kill the Israelite kids. Because, of course, a 3-month-old baby in the river is just going to be helpless and drown. And it's amazing. It's by faith. It says in Hebrews 11, it's by faith that they actually disobey the command of Pharaoh and withhold this little baby and put him in this dangerous river for him to be preserved. Because nothing of what is their experiencing would lead them to believe this is a good idea. And the baby is found by Pharaoh's daughter, and Miriam, who's there, actually is one of the Israelites, and suggests that she go find somebody to nurse the baby, and she goes and finds her mother. And so you begin to see that actually, while this process is painstaking, while it seems absence of God, the series of coincidences really begins to serve these people in their struggle and in the midst of what's going on. And I think sometimes it's easy to go, well, that was handy. I'm glad it worked out that way. But I think often we actually miss the little moments where God is intervening and he is doing things that seem like, well, I don't want to go crazy. Is that really God? I mean, how is it that these coincidences, so to speak, are happening in a way that is intervening in the situation? And as we know, the story goes, Moses is then taken as the son of Pharaoh's daughter and raised in the house of Egypt. There is so much story to be had there, but I want to make sure that I get to a key part of it, because it has so much to do with the process. Moses then grows up. He's 40 years old, as it were. We learn that from Acts 7 as the story is retold. He's 40 years old, and in Acts 2, verse 11, it says this: "One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens." He knew that he was an Israelite, and he cared for them in the midst of their struggle. It says, "And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together, and he said to the man in the wrong, 'Why do you strike your companion?' He answered, 'Who made you prince and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?' Then Moses was afraid and thought, 'Surely the thing is known.' When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian." This is so important to hit on in these couple of chapters, because what we see is the process in Moses' life as it's paralleling the process that God is taking the Israelites through. What we see is that, amazingly, God had a plan that, spoiler alert, manifests itself in Moses, but that only started really 80 years before it was going to come to fruition. Why do I say 80 years? Well, because what happened is he fled to Midian for 40 years. So he was born 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in Midian. He was 80 years old. So it was like, you know, the Israelites, under all of this terrible suffering and pain, desperately needed help. And God was like, I am starting a process. It's going to take 80 years. I mean, isn't that just so what it often feels like? Because there is such a quick leap to a desire for the thing to be solved, to be fixed, which would ultimately just subvert what God wants to do through this process. I say that word over and over again because we need to understand just how vital it is in our lives. And here we see Moses, and maybe you can relate to this. You have some vision or dream for your life. You feel like you've got this calling, and you just run out there with all kinds of zeal and just completely screw it up. Or you just, it comes out, but it comes out weird and awkward and clumsy because you're pretty much thinking, okay, this is the calling on my life, so all that's going to happen by the time I'm 22. I mean, if you're anything like me, all these stories of people who are like billionaires by 25 and have cured, you know, malaria or whatever it is, they're able to do these things at such a young age. And you're like, well, why aren't I doing that? Why hasn't the thing that I felt like God was going to do in my life happened yet? Happened now, happened right away, as soon as it was physically possible. And it's funny because I actually have come to love the Midian story. Midian feels like such a waylay, doesn't it? Such a detour. This guy's supposed to be this deliverer. He's got this incredible plan. The Israelites are in incredible need, and he just goes away for 40 years. And so many of us live Midians actually with some real hopelessness, despair, and we despise what we're experiencing because it doesn't seem to be the thing that we were supposed to do, and the manifestation of all of this stuff that God had seemed to promise, all of a sudden we're now on a detour. We're totally waylaid. But there was early evidence of this calling. I remember when I was in school, I went to school, many of you know, to be a doctor. I went to school pre-med, and I loved being pre-med because I could say I was pre-med as if it applied to expertise in everything, right? So people would say, like, you can't do it. I'm like, don't worry, I'm pre-med. Somehow that just, they didn't say any, they had no response to that. And what's funny is, like, I sort of qualified myself as some medical person. I don't know what I was hoping people would believe about me. But if any of you know, pre-med is English, calculus, physics, organic chemistry, chemistry, and biology. Virtually nothing about medicine. I mean, other than sort of, you know, indirect. But for those who didn't know that, it was a wonderful line. Don't worry, I'm pre-med. So I had my own kind of Egyptian moment, actually. Funny thing is, as I stand here now, I'm not a doctor. Somehow, all of what was stirring in me that was very valid, I mean, go figure, I wanted to help people. I wanted to serve people. I wanted to help heal people. That was like the deepest desire of my heart. And I thought, okay, got it, doctor. Well, it's interesting, I wanted to be a heart surgeon. I attended many heart surgeries in the process of this, just fascinated with the process. But the trouble is I didn't love science, which is problematic if you're going to be a doctor. And yet this thing was still churning in me. Who knew that many, many, many years later, I would become a bit of a doctor of the heart, as it were. I know that sounds super cheesy, but it's true. God was making in me a pastor. God was making something in me that I couldn't even quite conceive of, but I thought I had figured out at the age of 18, where you pretty much know everything. And that all led to doctor. And it was very frustrating when I left the pre-med program my junior year because it just wasn't quite what I thought it was going to be. And I thought, well, does that just mean I am waylaid now? So enthusiastic about being a doctor, I was with some friends of mine at a party in Providence. I went to Boston College, and we were staying with his family. We went to this party, and we had just gotten going. We had driven like an hour to get there. The party was great. We're having fun. These two guys were horsing around on the deck outside the house, and one guy pushed another guy through a window and cut his hand open, like really badly. And I mean, things were just getting going, and my friend, whose brother was the guy who cut his hand, he was my buddy. That was his younger brother. He's like, we got to go to the emergency room. I'm like, emergency room? This thing's just gotten going. I mean, this party's great. We can't leave now. We'll be at the emergency room for like 3 or 4 hours. And he's like, well, what do you suggest? I was like, I can sew him. I'm pre-med. And he's like, you cannot sew him. I'm like, no, trust me. It's easy. It's no problem. All we need is some white thread. It can't be colored because that'll have a dye and that's bad. I made that up. And a sewing needle. So we just need to walk around the neighborhood, just get me some white thread and a sewing needle. We did. We came back to the house. I had one of those architect's desk lamp that like magnifies, and he had a bottle of whiskey, which was advisable at the moment. So I put a little of the whiskey on his hand. He took a sip. I took a sip. He's like, why are you drinking the whiskey? Trust me, I'm pre-med. And I sewed his hand, and we had a great night. I mean, it was a blast. I was staying with their family, and his mom was not impressed with what had happened. She took him to the doctor the next day, and he was like, actually, looks pretty good. You can come back. I can take him out, or in another week and a half, you can just cut him out yourself. And I was like, I'm pre-med. What can I tell you? No experience or training whatsoever in this. It was a bit of an Egyptian moment. It's a bit of a long story considering, but it's one of these things where you just begin to see that early callings are manifesting themselves in awkward and clumsy ways. But the truth is, my true calling would not really start to manifest itself for many years. I actually had to take a pretty massive detour in the midst of that. Many of you know this, especially if you're older. I have become the worst predictor of the outcome of my life. Every season is an absolute and utter surprise to me. Why? Because I have this very distinct idea of how it's going to go. I am certain of what lies ahead. I know what's happening. I plan for it, and then I literally go that direction. Every time I make a big plan, this is what seems to happen. I find myself in a Midian of sorts. And it can be a very hopeless place. I mean, talk about midlife crisis. Here Moses is at 40. He's got some heart and vision to do this wonderful thing to bring justice that manifests itself in this Egyptian moment. And then he just gets completely taken out of the game. Do you feel taken out of the game? Do you feel waylaid or detoured in terms of what you feel like God has put on your life? It is very likely that he has you in a process where the outcome is his intended outcome and not yours. So easy for us to get a few clues and then just sew up the future in a really pretty picture. And I suspect that that is part of what Moses was doing right here. I know what it is. I've got this justice burning in me for my people. I'll kill this guy. And in fact, it was illegal. It was immoral. And Midian, however, saved his life. Pharaoh would have killed him. He would have died. That would have been the end of it. Our Midians are lifesavers. Though they may be detours, though they may be unexpected turns or jogs in the road, they are lifesavers. He met his wife in Midian. There's this wonderful quote by the famous preacher John Wesley that says, Moses fled from Pharaoh. God ordered this for wise ends. Things were not yet ripe for Israel's deliverance. The measure of Egypt's iniquity was not yet full. The Hebrews were not sufficiently humbled. That one really gets me right in the solar plexus. Those detours are often because we're not sufficiently humbled. Nor were they yet increased to such a multitude as God designed. They weren't yet strong enough. Moses is to be farther fitted for service and therefore is directed to withdraw for the present, till the time to favor Israel, even the set time, had come. God desperately wants to mete out his plan and purpose through a process. The first part's the good news. The second part can feel like the bad news. And in the midst of everything they were experiencing, and now the fact that Moses is off somewhere raising sheep, it would just seem that all hope was lost. Their kids were dying. They were under extraordinary toil. Moses, the planned deliverer, even though nobody knew that, was nowhere to be found. And yet, the third thing we see and have to understand in the story is that the process leads to deliverance. We won't get into deliverance today. That's still a ways off. A ways off. There's still a process to be had. And yet, here is what we see at the very end of chapter 2. It says, during those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered with his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. That is the foreshadow of what's to come. That is when finally God breaks into this story of Exodus, having seemed to be quite absent for hundreds of years. We have the assurance of his presence. I think in some ways, if you're not careful, you can be frustrated because even that word that's used, God remembered, seems to be evidence of what we all suspect at one point or another. Aha! He forgot! I knew it! See? I knew he had forgotten. Because that is how we feel. Did you remember what we talked about? This was like 10 years ago. Do you remember? See, the thing we have to understand about this remember is it wasn't that he had forgotten. It's that he now brought this to bear. He now brought this to be relevant in the situation. He now took this thing and he went, I never forgot for a moment. And I watched every single moment of every day of your life. And it's taken a while, and you've struggled, and you've suffered, and it's been painful, but now I am bringing it to bear. That promise, that calling, that vision that you have meditated upon, that you have held, I'm actually now bringing that to bear. Because like the Israelites, you hadn't been sufficiently humbled. You weren't strong enough. There were things I needed to do by a process that could not be done any other way. It's how I do things. He remembers. The other beautiful thing that we learn and we've got to cling to in this, because our hopes so often get set on the manifestation of the promise rather than the promiser, is not only did he remember, but he heard them. He hears every single prayer that you pray. He hears every single prayer that we pray. As we gather for 133 this Wednesday, he hears those prayers and then he sees. I love that because you know why? So often we get into the situation where our biggest question is, does anybody see what's going on here? Does anybody see just how frustrating this whole situation is? Does anybody actually see what I'm experiencing? And the truth of the matter is, God sees everything. Whatever happened this morning while you slept last night, what happened last year, and in the last 10 years, he sees all of it. Even when we clumsily fumble around trying to see one another and fail miserably, God sees. And he was making a plan, but it wasn't the guy that we're to put our trust and hope in. He was quite a flawed figure. It was the overarching and sure character and plan of God. The last thing it says is God knew. The beauty of this is that God knew what no one else did. He knew what his plan was. He knew what was about to happen in chapter 3. We get to the burning bush. I won't go there. He knew the timing of things and how to bring this process about for his glory. Another translation says he knew it was time to act. Man, that's kind of now you know it's time to act? And yet it's perfect. After decades upon decades of suffering and trial and pain and death, now? Okay, God, you must know. That is his process. It seems to be cyclical, where he brings us into difficult circumstances, as he even led Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted. Even the enemy was a part of what proved and was the process of Jesus. If you feel like you're facing an enemy in this process, it is very likely that you are, that God is with you, but it is part of his plan. It is part of how he seems to bring about the redemption of his people, individually and as a group. I'm amazed, and I'll land with this, that even Jesus, as I mentioned earlier, went through a process. In Hebrews 5:8, it says this, and this one blows my mind. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. Jesus. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Even Jesus went through a process. That has to be so comforting for us. And the thing that I find so amazing that is at the hardest point of his process that we know, which is the Garden of Gethsemane. This is what's amazing, because I just only noticed this recently. The hardest moment of his process, he cried out to God and he said, if there's any way that this cup should pass from me, if there's any way that I don't have to go to this cross and die to be the ultimate deliverer, not the Moses flawed, imperfect deliverer, but to be the deliverer of all people out of all bondage and slavery forever, if there's any way we can do this differently, he prayed, but not my will, yours be done. The thing that's amazing about that dialogue is it's not a dialogue. It's a monologue. God says nothing. He knows what it sounds like when God seems to be silent. It's just amazing. God says nothing, but Jesus then says, okay, got it, I'm going. Oftentimes we need to just continue to put one foot in front of the other, because we know what God has said, we know what he's called us to, and it doesn't look like what we think it's going to look like, but we have to trust that the outcome is in his hands. Jesus modeled that perfectly. If there's any way this can pass from me, not my will but yours be done. I'd love for the band to come up. As we really just replace our lives in God's hands. It is so easy to want to take the thing back when the process is not going as we prescribe, as we plan, as we desire. And yet, in the good character of God, actually, these lives belong nowhere else but in the hands of one with perfect, loving, compassionate character who sent his son that we would not have to endure the process that Jesus did. Let's pray. Father, I just thank you that you tell these stories of your faithfulness, of their pain, that we can identify with both. God in heaven, I pray that you help us today, even as many of us sit in Midian-like circumstances with the hope somehow deferred. Lord, I pray that you would encourage us and let us know that it's not because of some terrible wrong that's been done or that you've forgotten or we're neglected. Lord God, I just pray that we would know and understand that you hear, you see, you remember, and you know. God, let us rest in that. Let us rest in that as we look to you now and replace our lives into your hands. In Jesus' name.